we all feel better.
In the dark, we all feel better.
In the dark, we all feel better.
Kick your ass!
And see, since he's my friend, I'll have to kick your ass too.
First you give us this stupid Poughkeepsie Tapes bullshit ripoff.
Because he's my boy.
Yeah. Check it. Let me tell you about these two dudes from Brooklyn. You won't view movies the same way again. Every 2 weeks you get something new. And hate it or love it, they break it down for you. Tom DJ and Derek Ferguson been writing for years. Got respect from the peers. Watch these movies for all benefit. The watching Halloween left Tom rather spit. How about a couple musicals or maybe Dennis Quaid? Or Tom's on a rant, directors be afraid. Episode's classic, don't get it twisted. And from the start, these two have been gifted. Tom loves Kristen and Derek loves Pam. Tom hates heroes and Derek can't stand. Remakes some movies that don't need remade. Watch out studios, they won't be played. So give it up for T and give it up for D. Coolest guys from Brooklyn this side of Jay-Z. My name's B hyphen and it's time to start. Cause we all feel better in the dark.
Black gloves make me look murderous.
No, Tom, it's that gleam in your eye that makes you look hysterical. And that deranged grin doesn't help either.
Well, you should not look talking to me about the straw dogs. I make it the beautiful pictures. I love the beautiful pictures.
Beautiful pictures with monkeys with straight razors cutting people's throats.
Not just the cutting of anybody's throat, cutting my wife's throat.
Which you're known for.
Yes. I keep it in the family.
Yeah, especially with your daughter. But that's a whole nother story,
and
right?
They're like, going, what the hell is going on here?
Well, if you know anything about horror movies, especially Italian horror movies, that is known as giallo,
Italian for yellow,
then you will probably guess that we are talking about Dario Argento.
Yes.
The subject of this episode of Better in the dark. I'm Derek Ferguson.
And I'm Tom DJ. And we have decided to do one of these episodes where we have a box set and we're going to talk about the movies within the box set. And this box set came out last year.
Right.
Is from Anchor Bay. It is the Dario Argento 5-film set, which emphasizes his giallo work. Giallo, even though it's considered a horror film, they're more like kind of like just really, really gruesome mystery movies.
Right. Back during the grand old days of the grindhouse movies during the 70s, there was a big boom in these Italian giallo movies. Not just Dario Argento, but there was a whole bunch of them that came out. Because, of course, this is how the Italian film industry works. Italian directors, even themselves, they admit that.
Right.
Somebody will make one movie, and it'll be a big hit, and then everybody.
That's a good movie. That's me making my movie.
Right. And everybody will make movies after that. Yes. Like back in the early 60s, we had, which to me is still my favorite, Hercules, Steve Reeves.
Right.
When that movie hit big,
we had a whole raft.
The Italian film industry made what came to be known as Sword and Sandal.
Right. Over in Italy, they were called Peplum.
Which usually starred Mr. Universes and Mr. Olympics and Mr. World bodybuilders as mythical heroes such as Hercules, Machista,
Samson,
Atlas, all these other guys. When Sergio Leone made his classic Spaghetti Western,
Fistful of Dollars,
what happened? The entire Italian film industry made nothing but Spaghetti Westerns for like the next 10 years.
When George Romero came out with a film called Dawn of the Dead, which was released in Europe as Zombie. All of a sudden, every Italian filmmaker had to have his zombie movie out.
There you go.
And the same thing happened when a certain film by the name of The Road Warrior came out and became an international hit. All of a sudden, we had such wonderful films as Warriors of the Wasteland, and my favorite, 1990, The Bronx Warrior.
Oh, yeah. Don't forget that. But that's how the Italian film industry works. And so when we had a whole period during the 70s where we had these Italian giallo, which are basically slasher
movies. They're kind of the precursor to the slasher film.
I guess you could say that.
They're one of the grandfathers of that genre.
And usually what these movies were that you had somebody running around killing people in all kind of imaginative, bloody, grotesque manners. And of course you did, because most of the killings were done from the point of view of the killer, and you didn't know who it was until the end of the movie.
But usually he wore black gloves. And in fact, as we know, one of the things that Dario Argento has said many times in interviews is that to get into his films, he tends to wear the black gloves during the murder scenes.
Those are usually his hands.
Right, exactly.
In the movies, yeah. When it's the murderer doing something, that's Dario Argento's hands.
Let's do a little bit of a biographical background on the great man. Do we have the right to call him a great, great man?
I would think so, considering the influence that he's had on plenty of filmmakers.
And the bulk of the information we are divulging in this episode is provided courtesy of Dark Dreams, the films of Dario Argento, which is the official English language Argento site, www.darkdreams.org. Argento was born in September of 1940, the son of a movie producer, Salvatore Argento. And in fact, his brother has gone on to become a great producer of films in his own right.
Mm-hmm.
He started his career as a movie critic for the Rome Daily Press, Passe a Sera, and became a professional screenwriter, collaborating with, of all people, Bertolucci, on the screenplay for Sergio Leone's epic western, Once Upon a Time in the West, in 1967. Several screenplays later, Argento caught the attention of Goffredo Lombardo, head of Titanus, an Italian film company, and made his first film, which is a great film, if you've not seen it, you should, called The Bird with the Crystal Plumage. This preceded him on his path, and he did several of these giallo films. There's a loosely connected, what they call the animal trilogy, Bird with the Crystal Plumage, Three Flies on Grey Velvet, Cat of Nine Tails. The next one that he did was Deep Red. Our good friend David Hemmings, who we talked about
in the last episode. Right, I think that first Dario Argento movie I saw, I remember going to see that on 42nd Street.
Perhaps the one that most people, when you say the words Dario Argento to, that comes vividly to life, is a certain film called Suspiria.
Oh, yeah.
Done in 76, which, I love this story, I've told this story before. Argento wanted a specific look for this film. And so what he did was he located, at that time, the last factory in the world that produced Technicolor film, and bought the remaining amount of their stock. But the thing was, the stock was kind of old already. It was decaying. And that's why, if you've ever seen Suspiria, that the way that the colors look so super oversaturated.
It's
because he shot it on film that was literally falling apart in the camera.
But it gives the movie a unique look that I've never seen in any other. It looks like a fever dream when you're watching it. Wow. I mean, just visually, it's just mind-blowing. You look at it, and it doesn't look like any other movie I've ever seen.
Some other films that we want to mention before we get to the five that we're going to talk about.
Okay.
Inferno, which was the sequel to Suspiria.
Suspiria, right.
Which actually makes more sense than Suspiria. I think it's actually the better film.
Mm-hmm.
Opera, which I love. I once, because I'm such an Argento freak. Opera had never been shown in America. It was delayed for a long, long time. I was living in Long Island with a friend and his wife. We found out that they were showing opera at a college way, way out in the middle of nowhere in Suffolk County. And we drove the 2 hours on a work night to see this film. And I don't regret it because it's probably his last truly great film.
I didn't drive for 2 hours to see opera. I've never seen opera.
Opera's a great film. He did a version of The Phantom of the Opera. And most recently, he finally finished the Three Mothers trilogy that he started with Suspiria with The Mother of Tears, which is the most recent film I think he said. He's presently filming a film based on an American screenplay written by Sean Keller, who is a good friend of the Drunken Zombie crew, called Giallo, oddly enough. Some more interesting things, he's, of course, like his brother, he's produced stuff for various protégés that he's engendered throughout his career, including Michael Suave, who directed, of course, one of my favorite films, Cemetery Man.
Right, okay.
This is something I didn't know until today. He made a run for political office in 1997. Really? How would you like him to be your representative?
At least it'd be fun, because when the competition starts dropping dead... Now, Dario.
See, I do not wear the black gloves. I am not the killer.
Yeah, okay, Dario.
And he presently, in addition to making films, he runs a store/museum in Rome called Profondo Russo, which you can go to, which contains a lot of memorabilia from his films. Very great. Maybe not the greatest family man, as we're about to learn.
No, he's not.
But the thing to understand about Argento is Argento's not the most coherent person in the world when it comes to storytelling. And I've always tried to approach his films as kind of bizarre fever dreams.
Yeah, that's what they are. They're movies that take place in the mind of a madman.
Yeah, really. I mean, even the one of the five that we're about to discuss that makes the most sense, which is Tenebre, doesn't make a lot of sense.
No, it doesn't. He bases his movie mostly, I think, on just emotion. He's going for that visceral gut, you know,
impact. I
sometimes
wonder if he comes up with ideas for images first. Once he has like five or six really great images he wants to use in his movies,
then he builds the story around. Phenomena, that's probably
the most coherent.
Yeah, and still, if you really sit down and think about it logically and pick it apart, the damn thing makes no sense at all.
There's no real reason for the first of two characters to do what they did except to inspire the second of the two characters.
And then there's the monkey.
The monkey. Well, yeah. It's a weird world, and I'll be the first to admit that, I know, like, for example, our good friend Des cannot stand Argento. I'll be the first to admit that Argento is an acquired taste. It's
and then
something
there's
you
a,
either, and you may never get that taste.
And then there's a movie that I was telling you the other night, I emailed you, that's it. The one with Tony Franciosa.
Yeah, Tenebre.
Yeah, Tenebre. Now, this is a movie where, even in an Argento movie, the characters act oddly.
Yeah.
Now, saying that there are odd characters in an Argento movie is a redundancy.
Mm-hmm.
But even for Argento, you just look at these movies and you say, what the hell are they doing? Why did he do that? Why? And then when you find out the identity of the other killer and find out why he did it, it's just...
Right.
Yeah. But we'll get to that.
Well, we might as well start since the first film we're going to talk about is, in fact, Tenebre.
Okay, let's start with that.
Released here in the States in 1982 as Unsane in a very, very cut-up edition.
Well, most of his movies that were shown here, most of them were cut up horribly, and it wasn't until later on. And, of course, now that we have DVD, we can see them in their uncensored, uncut glory.
Right. Yeah. And this stars Tony Franciosa.
Yeah.
John Saxon.
Who plays his agent.
Yes. Argento's wife, Dario Nicoldi, who, oddly enough, it was not Argento's first choice. Argento wanted to go with an American actress. But Nicoldi had been on a famous television play shortly before filming started. And it was the studio who said, why don't you have your wife play this character? And he said, well, the studio was right. The studio, I think that we got a much better... Personally, Nicoldi, well, we'll get to it later after we finish talking about the story. As usual, you guys just gotta bear with us, because trying to summarize an Argento film is kind of like trying to juggle with water.
Tony Franciosa, he plays an American writer.
Mystery writer.
Horror slash mystery books. And he's just written a bestseller called
Tenebre.
Tenebre. And he's come over to Italy, because he's very popular in Italy, and he's come there for a book tour.
And John, he's accompanied by his agent,
John Saxon,
and his secretary, who is played by Dario Nicoldi.
Right.
As he arrives in Rome, there is a killer running around, killing people in the manner of the book, and then stuffing pages torn from the book
in the mouths of his victim.
The detectives kind of sort of think that maybe Franciosa is doing this to kind of engender publicity or something.
This is where we begin to see the oddness of how these characters go. Because the Tony Franciosa character asked the detective something, and that was really a small question. Because they come to him, and they're asking him, where were you when this girl was killed? And he said, well, I was on a plane coming over from America. And he said, let me ask you a question. If somebody's killed with a Smith & Wesson 38, do you go to the president of Smith & Wesson and question him?
Right.
What are you questioning me for? And then the secretary, played by
Dario Nicoldi,
she comes and she says, do you want anything to drink? She said, I'd offer you something stronger, but I know that you don't drink on duty. And what a cop said, that's the only time I do drink. Give me some scotch. And I'm like, wait a minute. So they start acting weird right out of the box.
He decides, since the cops think I'm doing it, I'm going to go investigate this myself. Meanwhile, there's this woman stalking him.
Yeah.
Sometimes she's described as his ex-wife. Sometimes she's just described as an ex-girlfriend.
His fiancé. Right. It's never really clear. It's clear they had a relationship, but what she actually was, you never really find out.
While this is going on, we're getting these flashbacks to this strange set piece involving this woman in white.
With these blindingly Freudian red high-heel shoes. And you know that woman was played by a transgender actor.
I did not know that.
Yes. When I was watching the DVD and I was watching the interviews, then I went online and I looked up because she's a very striking looking woman. And I found out that, she's a transgender. You know,
dear.
It's flashbacks and you don't know if they're dreams or if the actual flashbacks where she's on a beach. And it's obviously a very highly sexually charged...
Right. It's like some sort of implication that there's like this gang rape of this woman that ultimately results in her murder. Francisco's trying to investigate with the help of Nicaldi. They kind of discover that... And this is where I think things kind of... Once again, it's an Argento film, so we have to take a lot on faith. It turns out to be this big fan of his who's like a TV personality.
Right.
Who is perpetrating these things for who knows what the fuck. I can't understand why he does
it. Yeah, because when Tony Francisco is being interviewed, and he's interviewed by this woman, obviously they're very close friends, and then he has an interview with her, and she starts viciously attacking him. Oh, what's the sexism in your world? And he says to her, well, what's the matter with you? You've known me for 10 years. And she keeps on with this really vicious attacking him, calling him a misogynist, and you hate women, and you just write this stuff to make money. And then after the interview is over, they go back to being friends again, and he kisses her. Oh, you coming over for dinner? She says, oh, my mother wants to meet you. I'm saying... Wait a minute. Do they like each other? Do they not like each other? Are they... What's going on? So she gets murdered, her and a lesbian lover, in a pretty graphic scene. Yeah.
In fact, that's probably one of the most famous shots in the film, which is one of the two women looking through her t-shirt at the killer. Probably the most famous still of that.
And he takes the razor and he cuts it open, and she's looking through the t-shirt and she's pulling it over her head. Yeah. And she gets cut up, and the other woman, she's walking around naked, and she gets cut up.
A lot of nudity in Argento films.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a good thing.
Well, I mean, considering they got good-looking bodies. Mm-hmm.
But we ultimately learn, and I'm going to put the spoiler klaxons on this.
Okay.
Is that the actual killer, who, like I said, was this TV personality who was a fan of Franciosa's work and was looking upon this as some sort of way of, I don't know what.
You never really understand why he just started killing people.
Franciosa discovers this, kills the guy, but conceals the murder.
Yeah.
So he can then use it to kill this bothersome ex-wife, ex-girlfriend. Like, make it look like it was the last.
It was just another murder, of this guy. Since he's killing everybody, has a connection to Franciosa anyway. But he says, well, if I kill her, and people just think it was him that was doing it.
The detective kind of figures it out about the same time that Franciosa is putting his plan into effect. So he's got to go.
The detective solves the mystery by accident, really. And we should mention right here that it's obvious to me that Argento doesn't have a lot of respect for the police and authority because the police are always...
idiots.
Yeah. They're not just one step behind the killer. They're five steps behind the killer. They have no clue at all.
And have a different map.
As to what they're doing. This guy solves the mystery completely by accident. He literally stumbles into Franciosa after he killed the wrong person.
And it ends with Franciosa dying. And a famous last shot of Dara Nicaldi coming across this. The thing is that Nick's very, very clear the secretary has feelings for Franciosa.
You're right.
And they're kind of coming together throughout the film until Franciosa fakes his own suicide with a straight razor. When she finally discovers that A, he's still alive. B, he just hacked a woman to death.
With an axe, yeah.
C, she just killed him by accidentally backing him onto a steel sculpture. You get the impression everything just snaps in her. And she just starts screaming.
Because she screams through the whole credits.
Through the whole credits.
Yeah. It's like 5 minutes of credit. Well, not 5 minutes. Let's say about 2-3 minutes. Because this was the 70s when credits were much shorter. But it's 2-3 minutes where she's constantly screaming through the credits. And you get the impression she's going mad. Because her mind is just snapped from the realization that, oh my God, I've been in love with this man. And this man is a maniac.
I think this is the best of the five.
Because I think at the end of the movie, five people are killed in the last 10-15 minutes of the movie. You know? And there's literally...
The Saxon gets off. The original killer gets off. So Franciosa fakes his own death.
Right. Then he comes back.
Kills the ex-girlfriend.
Kills the detective.
Then gets killed by accident.
There's literally bodies stacked on top of each other. Stacked on top of each other by the end of the movie.
It's probably the most coherent of the films we're trying to talk about. I think it's a brilliant twist, the idea that Franciosa says, well, hey, somebody's already killing people. I might as well use it to get rid of this problem.
I might as well cash in.
We talked about the t-shirt. There's the other rather amazing shot where apparently it was done in only one take because they couldn't afford to have a second take, which is the murder of the ex-wife.
Oh, yeah.
Which is done in a very white room where she's wearing a very white dress. And so when a limb gets hacked off, there is a spray of blood.
Yeah, she's sitting next to a window and the axe crashes through the window and chops her arm off in half. Blood is gushing like a fire hose.
Yeah.
And she stumbles from the living room into the kitchen, literally spraying blood all over the place. It's an amazing shot. But there's another amazing shot, too, where... Tony Franciosa been caught by the detective, and the detective said, okay, well, turn around, put your hands behind your back, and he comes out with a straight razor, and he cuts his own throat, and blood is gushing everywhere, and he falls to the floor. And the detective says, oh, shit. Okay, so him and the secretary, they go outside, and then he says, okay, well, you wait in the car. I got to go back. I got to secure the crime scene. Right. I got to call somebody. And he comes back, and he sees that Tony Franciosa's body is gone.
Right.
He picks up the straight razor, and it's one of these movie straight razors that's got fake blood in the handle, and when you press a button, blood comes out of little holes in the thing. And then he bends down, and we see Tony Franciosa standing right behind him.
Yes.
Oh, man. Now, see, that's a jump out your seat moment, because I was like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
And, you know, I said, now, that's great.
But even though it is probably the best and most coherent film in the it still doesn't make a lot of sense.
No, it doesn't.
It's one of the reasons why I don't get angry at people like this who say to me, I don't like Argento because I can't understand the stories.
Yeah, John Saxon gets killed in broad daylight in the middle of a square where people walk, and it seems like nobody notices this.
Argento's films happen in this weird parallel universe. It's like the Argento universe is the dark side of the Avengers universe.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, well, wait a minute. There are people walking around. Didn't they just see this guy with this 5-foot-long butcher knife sticking into John Saxon?
Giggling in that wheezing way all the time.
Oh, man. It is an enjoyable movie. I had a good time watching
it.
I did. I liked it a lot.
I do want to point out that these discs all have really cool extra features.
Yes, they do.
Including, there's always, each one has a little mini interview with Argento where he talks specifically about making of each film.
The one you ought to watch, though, folks, if you get this particular set, watch the one where he's interviewed by Joe Franklin.
Yeah, that's on the next.
He is such a freaky looking character.
Yes.
Back in the day, you look at him and say, wow.
Oh, he's never looked like a normal person. He looks like the assistant in a horror movie.
But now he looks like a little bit more mature.
Yeah, of course.
But back in the day, back then, man,
with
he
that,
was
like dark, dark hair and the.
Ah, he was a freaky looking cat. If you haven't seen any Argento movie, I would suggest you start with that one, Tenebrae.
Yeah, it's a good entry point. The story is more or less easier to follow.
And of course, you've got these American actors like Tony Franciosa and John Saxon, who people are familiar with.
Yeah.
So it's easier to get into the story when you see actors that you recognize. Mm-hmm. People do odd things in this movie where they stop talking about the murderer, and Tony Franciosa looks at John Saxon and says, "What's up with that hat?" Doesn't it come off? And John Saxon waves his hand around and says, no, season. And then they go back to talking about the murder.
Yes.
And I said, what the hell is that all about?
We're not going to be talking about these films, but for the longest time, Four Flies and a Grey Velvet was not available on DVD or video. I got a rare chance to meet Argento, thanks to my association with Fangoria, where I got a phone call from my editor going, do you want to meet Dario Argento?
Shit, yeah.
Because he knew what a big Argento. I said, yeah, the sky is blue, too.
Yeah, right. Did you have to really
ask? It turned out that they were showing one of the few remaining prints of Four Flies of Grey Velvet at the Film Forum, and Argento was going to introduce it. So I got to meet him, and we got to have dinner afterwards.
Oh,
totally
man.
Cool.
I hate your guts.
The reason I bring this up is seeing Four Flies and Grey Velvet on the big screen, which isn't very good, there's this one bizarre scene where the main character goes off and talks to his friend who's called God.
Okay.
Who's like a hobo.
Okay.
Who lives out in the woods outside of Rome. There's usually these weird sort of like side characters that don't make a lot of sense.
Yeah, yeah.
Cat of Nine Tails, there's like this whole thing going on with Carl Malden as the blind guy.
Right.
There's all these weird. And of course, what we're about to get into now, Phenomena.
Phenomena, yep.
What the fuck is Donald Pleasance doing in this movie?
Yeah, he's.
Donald Pleasance and his pet helper monkey.
He's a weird side character. He plays a pivotal role, but you still have to wonder, what the hell was he doing in this? You have to wonder what the hell the whole movie was about anyway, because you've got two completely disparate stories and elements that Argento just mashes together.
Right. Well, in the little mini documentary where they interview Argento about this film particularly, he talks about how in Phenomena he wanted to create an adult fairy tale. I saw that interview and looked at it again, and you can kind of sort of see what he's saying here, because you've got the little princess, and you've got the dark castle, and the evil parent, all these elements of a fairy tale.
Right, and we should mention that the exquisitely beautiful Jennifer Connelly, this was, I think, her second film.
And apparently she did not like Argento too much, because he wrote opera specifically for her, and she said she didn't want to do it.
But she's riding in the car with the woman who eventually we find out is behind the wheel.
Yes.
So, and she tells her right from the start, well, I want you to look at me as being your mother while you're here. Yeah, so I see what she's going with the evil stepmother type of thing. And, of course, all the other girls at the school are like the wicked stepsister who torment her and plague her. And,
yeah, well, so because she's an odd little girl. Jennifer Connelly is sent to this boarding school in Zurich, Switzerland.
Yeah. It's constantly mentioned that her father's going to be some kind of big movie star. Okay. Or something, even though we never see him. It's
because that would break, if we saw the father, that would break the whole idea of it being a fairy tale.
Exactly, yeah.
So she's sent to Zurich, which Argento spends a great deal of time establishing that it's considered the Swiss Transylvania.
Yeah, that's constantly referenced enough to say, okay, we got it.
It's
a spooky place.
Very early on, you get the impression that Jennifer's character is a little weird. Probably very early on when she first meets Donald Pleasant's character, who is an ophthalmologist. He's just a weird character. He's an ophthalmologist who's paralyzed from the waist down, who has this female helper monkey to help him around the house. And he's also a consultant for the police department up in Zurich because his area of expertise is how insects help with decay.
Fans of CSI, they would get a kick out of that scene where he explains it because the same thing that Donald Pleasance does, I've seen done in a couple of episodes in CSI where they actually look at maggots. Depending on the size of the maggots and how old they are, they can tell how long it's been. They can predict to within the hour, the minute, how long it's been that the body is dead.
Mm-hmm.
But we even get a hint that Jennifer Connelly is weird even before then because when she's in the car going to the boarding school, a bee gets inside the car.
Right.
And the driver's freaking out and the woman is freaking out. And she says, oh no, don't kill it, don't kill it. And she holds the bee in her hand and the woman says, it's a bee, are you crazy? She says, no, insects love me.
Yeah, and we find out that she's not joking around. That insects have some sort of weird affinity with this girl. Which, of course, because she's a little weird, we all know how cruel kids can be. Meanwhile, there are these murders going on. The first murder, of course, occurring when the mysterious glove killer kills the first of two Argento daughters. In fact, this, is the only time that the eldest Argento daughter is killed in a film. I think Daria Nicoli said, that's it. Nope. She ain't doing this no more.
Yeah, she ain't doing it no more. Yeah, she gets killed in a pretty gruesome way, too.
She's
strangled with a chain.
stabbed repeatedly with scissors, and then thrown off a great height into a falls.
No, she's decapitated. It's her head that falls.
Oh, the head falls. Okay. Yeah.
She goes through a mirror. She goes
in
back.
In slow motion, no less.
And you don't know if the killer cut off her head or if the glass just cut off her head. The next thing you see is that her head falls. It's a very surrealistic, dreamlike sequence. Argento has been accused many times, including his ex-wife, of not liking women and being very misogynistic. This first killing takes quite a long time.
Oh, there's just this famous quote that he once said. I wonder what was going through his head when he gave it to the press, where he said, it's just more interesting when a beautiful girl dies.
Yeah.
And I'm fuck?
I remember that,
I love Argento as a filmmaker, but he's not a well man.
That ranks right up there with that the things that you're not supposed to say in public.
Like,
remember when Michael Jackson said that, well, I see nothing wrong with sleeping with little boys. They're just some things you can't say.
Okay, Daria, we're stepping a couple of steps away from you now.
I find it disturbing that in every one of his movies that has his daughter Asia, he find some way to get her naked.
That's
very disturbing to me.
From what I understand, Mother of Tears is no exception to this. In fact, if anything, it's an escalation. Getting back to Phenomena.
Yeah.
These girls are being killed, and we don't know why.
And we learned that Jennifer Connelly actually does have a psychic connection she has with insects.
Mm-hmm. As she demonstrates after she's been pushed one too many times by summoning a whole horde of flies down upon the school.
Mm-hmm. Which leads the headmistress to believe that she's possessed by the devil because of the Lady of the Flies.
The Lady of the Flies. Trying to describe this, once again, juggling water people, trying to describe what happens after that point makes not a lot of sense. There is this hidden, deformed child that is the product of the headmistress that is being kept in this sub-basement of the academy. For some reason, there's in the middle of this sub-basement, there is a swimming pool filled with maggots.
Yeah, and decaying corpses.
I think that's where she's taking the corpses and dumping them.
Yeah, she takes them and dumps them for whatever reason we don't know.
The impression I'm getting is that the child gets out, people see the child, she kills the people so that the knowledge of the child won't get out.
Right. With this weird lance-like type of weapon she screws on, which is effectively a bayonet to a long metal pole, and that's what she uses to impale her
villain. Donald Pleasance gets it.
We're never sure if he's dead dead or not because he doesn't have his face covered. Now, I don't know. Maybe that might be an Italian thing, but I know here in America, when a body's brought out, and if you're dead, they got the sheet over your face, and if you're still alive, they don't. But over there, you get the impression that he's dead from the way the monkey acts. But they don't have his face covered when he's brought out. But I guess since we never see him for the rest of the movie and he's never mentioned.
Yeah, and the monkey comes after the person who kills him. Which, by the way, Dario Nicoli got pretty badly cut.
Well, Jennifer Connelly got bit by the monkey.
Yeah, got bit by the monkey and she got pretty badly cut. I think that was the beginning of the end of the marriage.
I kind of would think so. But
let a monkey cut me!
But we see something very interesting in here that we see through a number of Argento movies. The police are totally ineffectual in catching this killer. So a private citizen, in this case, Jennifer Connelly, takes it upon herself to try to find a killer.
Yeah.
And Donald Pleasant says, okay, well, with your psychic ability to communicate with insects, the insects can lead you to the body. And he gives her a fly. He says, okay, well, the fly leads you to the dead bodies. You always have these average citizens that take it upon themselves
in
an Argento
movie.
With
the crystal moon.
Right. Tony Musante was the guy in that movie that took it upon himself to try to find the killer.
Which is an unofficial remake of The Screaming Bebe. The American precursor to the giallo. That's right. It's always about, and this is something that we're going to see in all of these films, that these are people who get dragged into this not of their own accord and have to solve these problems for various reasons. Phenomena was the last one to get released here in the States theatrically.
It was released
under the name Creepers.
Creepers, right.
And in fact, this is where you will find that bizarre moment where Joe Franklin has him on the show.
Yeah.
Him and a stuntman. And it's just...
Right, it's a stuntman. And the stuntman is so shameless at just promoting himself because they've been talking about Dario Argento's film, and Joe Franklin says to the stuntman, oh, well, what do you think? And the stuntman says, well, I think he needs more stuntmen in this movie.
Oh.
I said, do I smell dumbass here?
You know how it is. that was great about the Joe Franklin show is that anybody could be on his show.
When I was a kid, I loved watching Joe Franklin. Now, I know none of you out there don't know who he is now. Google Joe Franklin.
Yeah. The thing that was amazing about Joe Franklin is that he let anybody be on the show.
Yeah.
So you'd have J.P. Morgan, followed by the Ramones.
Yeah.
You know?
You never knew who was going to be on the show. I loved it when I was a kid, and it was on WOR.
Forever.
It ran for the longest time. I just watched it, and I ate it up. I wish it was still on.
There were two shows that if you wanted to see some of the most obscure musical act, you watched every time. Joe Franklin and Uncle Floyd.
Uncle Floyd.
Because Uncle Floyd would have Dramarama on, or all these other... Any band locally who wanted to be on Uncle Floyd could be on Uncle Floyd.
It was great stuff. But Phenomena is interesting also in another way. It's because you have a slasher movie, and it's hooked up with this supernatural aspect with her having the power over insects. But you got the thing with the killer running around killing people.
It kind of ties in a bit with opera, because opera also features a main character who has an affinity with a certain type of animal. Although I think opera is a better film, even though, like, it's Jennifer Connelly, who apparently did not have a good time, turned down the chance to be in it. But the next film in the box that we're talking about is the one that he made after opera, which was released here, I think in a very limited release, as Dario Argento's Trauma.
Oh, God.
This is maybe the nadir of the five that we're going to talk about today.
Right.
It's really not very good. Came out in 1993, shot in, of all places, Wisconsin, starring Christopher Rydell. This is the first of the major starring roles for Asia Argento, Dario's daughter, and someone that at least one of our friends thinks is one of the hottest women ever. So this is for you, Mon. And a couple of rather odd American names. Piper Laurie, Frederick Forrest, James Russo, Brad Dourif.
Yeah! When I heard about the cast, because just before I popped it in, I read who was in the movie, and I said, oh man, this is going to be good, because Piper Laurie, Frederick Forrest, James Russo, and Brad Dourif. This is probably the one movie I've seen Brad Dourif in that I didn't like his performance, and that's because it's not really a performance.
Right.
It's a cameo. He shows up for, like, 30 seconds, maybe 2 minutes.
So here we go, trying to juggle water again.
Okay.
Christopher Rydell plays a cartoonist for... At first, I thought it was a newspaper.
Right,
because
he's a cartoonist.
Until halfway through, you realize it's working for a television studio.
Why would a television studio need a cartoonist?
I have no idea. But anyway, Christopher Rydell is a cartoonist who, I guess driving home from work, comes across a young woman about to throw herself from a bridge.
Right.
He saves her despite her rather violent protests.
Asia Argento.
Takes her to a diner and feeds her, and he finds out that she's 16. She apparently ran away from an institution she was sent to.
Mm-hmm.
And she is a bulimic.
Because right after she eats, and she doesn't really eat that much, she goes and throws up.
Right.
Then she goes out the back
way. Yeah. Meanwhile, there's this, once again, all together now, people, black glove killer with this bizarre machine.
Yeah.
It's a bandsaw of some sort on like a continual loop that he loops over the people's heads, turns on, and it automatically decapitates them.
And it decapitates them. There's a motor in there, because you hear the motor going, and it cuts off the head of the person, because right at the beginning, we see the killer, black woman, she's a physical therapist of some sort. At first, he hits him to turn around, and then he hits him in the back of the head with a hammer.
Right.
He takes a decap-o-matic and puts it over.
Decap-o-matic. The Argento decap-o-matic.
He slips the Argento decap-o-matic over their head. Presses the button, cuts off the head, then takes the head with him.
Mm-hmm.
He keeps it for a souvenir.
Right. So he learns that the most recent murders that the decapitmatic mater, I don't know what we're going to call this killer, just committed were of the parents of Argento's character.
Right.
And so he tries to go and find her and help her because he figures, hey, this is, I guess, time for me to get into big time.
Well, when she leapt out of the diner, there were two mysterious guys, dun, 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 who snatched her off the street and took her back to the institution, which is run by Frederick Forrest.
Right.
He plays this really creepy guy.
Did you dub him the headhunter in the film?
Okay.
So I guess it's the best. I like the decap-o-maticator.
We have a brief flashback to see where he was having an affair with Asia Argento's mother, played by Piper Laurie, who's a medium who got killed during the seance she was having, her and her husband.
Well, we get the impression that she's a fake medium.
A fake medium.
A fake medium. Yeah. Her and her husband have this scam going.
But she gets decapitated by the decap-o-matic. And Frederick Forrest is trying to unlock her memories of how her mother got killed and how much she knows about what we're never really sure.
Yeah.
But it seems like he's really trying for people not to know he had an affair with this woman. Why? She's dead. What does it matter now? Who knows that you had an affair? Yeah.
Is she?
Dun, dun, dun.
Meanwhile, there's this little kid living next door to the decapitator, who, and in fact, probably the one really truly creepy scene in this film is when he sneaks into the killer's house, finds the decap-o-matic, and starts playing around with it because he doesn't know what it is. Which, and you're just like going, don't touch that kid.
Yeah, you're right, yeah, kid, don't play with that, you know. And another weird thing is also that when that physical therapist we saw get killed in the first scene, she had like a pet lizard or gecko.
Yeah.
And for some reason, the killer takes it, and then every time we see the killer's house, the lizard's just running around.
Yeah, it's just going crazy.
Eating butterflies, of all things. Why, I don't know, Argento has these shots of the lizard running around the house. And you say, well, why is that in there?
I think it's funny that the official website refers to this somewhat derisively as Argento's greatest hits.
Oh,
and I
far from
definitely, no, I didn't mean it in a negative way, and I can definitely understand what they mean by that, in that it seems like it's just Argento trying to put everything together that he knew worked in previous films. So here's a whacked out killer, here's a heroine who has these weird dreams that are misaligned memories.
I mean, the plot doesn't make a lick of sense.
Here's a killer who is a character that we thought was dead earlier in the film.
You don't have a likable character in the movie.
No, even Christopher Ardell's character, who's supposed to be the hero, you realize that his interest in Asia Argento, who is established very clearly as being 16, is sexual in nature.
Yeah.
It just turned me off to the character entirely.
And he's having this affair with one of the reporters at the, you know.
I think it's his boss, in fact.
Who's about like 20 years older than him. So apparently he's got these issues because he doesn't have a relationship with anybody his own age. They're either wildly older or wildly younger than him. He's as dumb as a loaf of bread.
Yeah. Oh yes. You know?
This guy couldn't put two and two together and come up with four if his life depended upon. And it does, because he's trying to find a killer.
I would call him as dumb as a box of rocks, but that would be mean to the box of rocks.
Yeah.
As heinous as Tony Franciosa character in Tenebre is, he's at least a charismatic person that we follow.
Right, exactly.
As weird as Jennifer Connelly's character is in Phenomena, at least she has enough of a charisma that we identify with her.
That we go along with her.
Not this guy. This guy's just like, get the fuck off my screen.
Yeah, a terrific actor like James Russo. Mm-hmm. You don't waste him playing. And again, we see Dario Argento does not have any respect for police because he plays a cop that's as dumb as a box of rocks.
Yeah.
He couldn't catch a cold. You have no confidence in him catching the killer at all. It took me 3 tries, folks, to get through this movie, because I kept falling asleep.
Yeah, and my favorite weird out of nowhere touch was the reggae band at the end.
Yeah.
Now keep in mind, it's shot in Wisconsin, it's supposed to be Minneapolis in the film, and out of nowhere, at the end, we have a reggae band. What the fuck?
I have no reason.
But
you have one point where he decapitates a nurse, because we find out that the killer is killing these nurses, and all the women were nurses that worked on this certain operation. Right. Brad Dourif was the doctor. And they find out that this is why they're getting killed, because they botched this one operation. One nurse gets killed in this hotel room. And the killer, now, this is really stupid, because if you kill somebody, your whole purpose is to get away afterwards. The killer sets off the fire alarm for some reason, mm-hmm. and then Christopher Rydell, he runs into the room where the body is at. She's been decapitated now for 5 minutes, but the head is still able to talk and tell him who killed him. Meanwhile, his water is pouring down on him. And you wonder, what is this scene about? Why is this scene there? Why didn't the killer take the head? He's been taking everybody else's head. Why did he leave this head behind?
Well, you see, I think this is an example of what is a trap you might fall into if you're an Argento fan like myself, which mm-hmm. is that sometimes Dario's methods come up with brilliance. Sometimes it comes up just a bunch of shit.
But like you said,
you know, just a bunch of crazy crap that happens.
I think that you hit the nail right on the head. He gets these 5 or 6 shots that he got to his mind. And I think he was just so intrigued with the image of this guy talking to this severed head laying there while the water's pouring down. Mm. That's what he wanted to get.
Right.
Why it happened isn't important to Dario. What matters is that you see that image and you think that that's exactly what he was going for there. He just wanted that
image. I mean, in his best films, Suspiria, Tenebrae, which we talked about, I think Bird with the Crystal Plumage is a fantastic film. Opera is a great film. He manages to, I won't say conquer this compulsion he has to just come up with the great images, but he manages to control it to varying degrees. I mean, Suspiria is a great film, but it doesn't.
But it's all images.
It's all images.
It's all images, yeah. After watching these, I'm glad you brought that up, because I'm definitely going to rent that movie. While I was watching Trauma, I said, damn, I wish I had Bird with Crystal Plumage, because I love that movie. Mm-hmm. First of all, it's got a great title, and it's one of his best movies.
And it's just that sometimes this method he has, he doesn't come up with enough connective tissue. So what you get is something like Trauma, which is just a bunch of crazy shit that's happening. Characterization is not a strong point, so of course he doesn't work that hard on it because he doesn't have that skeleton around those scenes.
Well,
so
he's got the skeleton, but he doesn't have any meat on the bone. That's all it is, but he's not fleshing it out with any, say, characterization or any rational, how do I get from this scene to this scene? That's really not something that really interests him. He just wants to get to the next interesting shot.
So, from here in the box set, we skip ahead almost 10 years.
Ooh.
During this time, apparently there was a big sea change in the Italian film industry, where more and more of the financing for films were coming from the purchase of the television rights for production started. This is something that Argento has talked about in recent interviews to support The Mother of Tears, the third mother, about how he's become more and more unhappy working as a director in Italy because working with the TV networks has imposed more and more constraints on his art. Now, sometimes with a great artist, and I think, as you and I both agree, Argento is a great artist.
Oh, yeah, he is.
Having constraints liberates him. But I think these next two films show how having constraints actually inhibit him. I'm talking, of course, about 2003's The Card Player.
Oh, God.
Now, I put Trauma worse than this film. Do you agree, or do you put this one below Trauma?
Trauma's pretty bad.
Trauma's pretty bad.
I'd have to say, this one at least has an interesting premise.
Yeah.
And I'll be honest with you, folks, I couldn't get through The Card Player because, like Trauma, honestly, I kept falling asleep on it. Again, we got the thing where Argento doesn't have any faith in police at all.
Which, like, considering that the main character is a police detective.
Yeah.
In fact, both of the main characters.
Yeah. I would rather have the cops from Reno 911 on this case than these guys, because they're totally inept.
One of the things I do think is interesting about this film is it's a much different look from the usual Argento film.
Yeah, it is. It's realistic. It's one of the most realistic Argento films that I've seen, because other films like Tenebrae, which takes place, it's a curiously depopulated kind of Rome.
And he's doing these compositions which are very, very stark contrast. Very
and
light,
the buildings
very dark.
Are slightly futuristic looking and Phenomenon. And
well, Phenomenon is the opposite of Tenebrae in that he's going for overtly dark.
Yeah.
And once again, trying to emphasize the gothicness.
The fairy tale quality, because it's kind of dreamlike. And of course, Suspiria, which is like a fever dream.
Yeah.
But The Card Player and Do You Like Hitchcock?
Do You Like Hitchcock? Well, he mentioned in the interview that accompanies the Card Player disc that he tried as an experiment to only use natural lighting.
Oh, okay.
Throughout the film. And it definitely is a very different look for him. It's a much softer look. The negative of that is that it also takes the film out of that Argento world, parallel universe.
Yeah. Card Player is a very conventional looking movie. It is.
Yeah.
Especially for Argento.
It is about a killer called the Card Player, who he kidnaps women.
Random women.
Random women, secures them somewhere, and then challenges the police to engage in video poker with him. For each hand that they win, they get closer to him freeing the victim.
They got
to
play five hands.
They got to play five hands. For each hand they lose, the victim loses something.
He cuts off something, yeah.
And at the very end, if they lose the fifth hand, she loses her life.
If they win the most hands, then he promises to let the victim go. And there are a couple of victims in the movie that he keeps his word. He just let them go. If they lose, hey.
We have this female detective who's in charge, played by Stefania Rocca, who is apparently a popular Italian television actress, which is, once again, this is the beginning of these really strong influences by Italian television.
Wait, no, she's attractive, and when I was talking to you before we started recording this episode, I was talking about how bad her performance, so you made a good point in that you said we got to remember one thing. This was dubbed also, so it could just be that it's a bad dubbing. Because she's attractive looking, the voice that they use, she doesn't look like she should have that type of voice.
A lot of people forget that Italian cinema convention is very different, the way they deal with their sound, is that they tend to have people speaking phonetic English and then either have them dub in Italian or get American voice actors to dub over in English. So there's no sync sound in many Italian films. Rocca joins with an Irish cop, who is a profiler, played by Liam Cunningham.
Right, he screwed up in some other job, and he's been sent to Italy in punishment for screwing up the job that he did before. Mm-hmm. And they start working together to find this card player.
Right. They are also working with a computer expert who she frequently works with, who is trying to help them. And they find some kid in a video parlor somewhere who's like an expert, you know, video poker player.
How they could tell, after watching him for 2 minutes, he's an expert. This is where the movie really fell apart. They got to play this game. So what you do is that you get on the phone, you say, okay, who's the best card player in Rome?
Or even better,
who's the best professional
player? Call up the people who put together the World Series of Poker.
Right.
Exactly.
Who's the best poker player that you got? Well, send them here. We need them. Instead, when the card player signs on, the cops are looking around each other. Well, who here knows how to play poker? Well, shouldn't you have thought of that before?
Yeah.
And they take this kid out of here, this 19-year-old college kid who really doesn't want to be involved.
Right.
And he's telling them, it really doesn't matter. It's all about luck. It really doesn't matter how good I play. Especially, it's video poker. It's not like you're sitting across the table from a human being where you can read his body language and read his expression. Then I can understand why they would pull this kid out of here and say, okay, well, there's somebody that you're playing against. It's a different thing, but you're on the computer. And it goes to another scene where one of the cops asks what, for an gentle cop, is really a smart question. Well, how do we know that he's not rigging the game? And they have another guy who's another computer expert.
Right.
He says, well, I could tell you why, but it's too complicated for you.
Well, in fact, it's funny that he brings this up and is shouted down when you have a situation where something is rigged later on in the film.
Exactly. Well, why wouldn't he have it rigged? These computer experts that they got, the guys that's supposed to be tracing the thing, they can't be too good at their job. You've got 14-year-olds who can hack your computer and find out where you're at in 2 minutes. And these guys have 20 minutes while they're playing the game, and they can't do it. It goes back to what I see as a recurring theme in this movie. He has this contempt for authority figures that they don't know what they're doing. They're not to be trusted because they have the head cop. He says, okay, well, don't play the first time that the card player you know, comes online. The female cop, she said, well, the girl is going to die. You know what he's going to do? He said, listen, it's my responsibility. We're not going to play. The card player cuts the throat.
Yeah.
Everybody's looking at him and saying, we didn't even give the girl a chance. The guy in charge, he just shrugs and says, hey, I fucked up. And he walks away.
The resolution is kind of silly. And it's also kind of blaringly obvious from about the half-hour mark who it is, who's the card player. Although the whole set piece, which involves chaining somebody to a train track while they're playing the game, and if you win against me, I'll give you the key and you can go.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is so dopey.
I mean, it's not a very good movie at all. It's not suspenseful. It's not thrilling. The characters aren't interesting.
I give it a lot of credit for the fact Argento consciously tried to do something very different with the look of the film. The other thing that kind of bothered me was that, and this becomes really noticeable now knowing what was going on behind the scenes, is how the violent set pieces are very muted.
There's a lot of violence there, but a lot of it takes place off screen. Whereas in early Argento movies, we would have seen, like, there's one scene where one of the card player's victims gets free while he's playing the game. Instead of her running and trying to get away, she attacks the guy. And we see him with the knife in his hand, and then we see him drag her off screen.
Yeah.
And then we hear the sounds of him stabbing him. We hear him screaming, but we don't see it. Now, in other Argento movies, oh, yeah, we'd have seen it. Because as you pointed out earlier, Dario Argento loves nothing better than seeing beautiful women get cut up on screen. Mm-hmm. This one, we don't get those over-the-top violent set pieces. We don't see women getting thrown through windows or getting stabbed or getting decapitated.
Or getting thrown through windows while being hung.
Right, stuff like that. The men in this movie usually get killed in a very straightforward manner. Boom, like Donald Pleasance, he gets stabbed another more. And that's it, one stick and that's it.
Yeah.
A woman in a Dario Argento movie gets stabbed at least a minimum of 15 times, and then she's still crawling away, and she's screaming, and blood is gushing, and she's still getting stabbed. And then her limbs get hacked off.
Yep.
She's still screaming. Then she gets thrown down a flight of stairs. She's still screaming. And then a rock just dropped on her head. That's a typical death scene for a woman in an Argento movie. But men, they get maybe one slice to the throat. Yeah. They get stabbed in the back. That's it. Boom. They go down.
Yes.
No screaming, no there yelling, no nothing.
So, now we come to the last one.
Okay.
The most recent film in the box set. This is 2003's Do You Like Hitchcock, which was made specifically for Rai Italy, the leading network, as part of a proposed anthology series Argento was looking to launch. And it is Argento saying over and over again, you know, I really like those Hitchcock movies. Remember Strangers on the Train? That was a good movie.
Yeah. Remember Psycho?
Yes, that was a good movie too. Rear Window, that was a great movie.
And all of these movies are referenced in this Do You Like Hitchcock?
When you first saw it, you sent me an email saying, you know what it looks like to me? It looks like a Brian De Palma version of an Argento version.
It's not Argento doing Hitchcock. To me, it looked and it played like Argento doing Brian De Palma doing Alfred Hitchcock.
It's, now, let's talk about the positive things. First off, we're back to that really wonderful, super lush Argento look.
Oh, yeah.
That kind of like alternate universe Argento.
I like how these people live in these magnificent apartments with these grand balconies.
But no lights. Well, look like their buildings have been around for ages.
Yeah.
Seem to have no electric lights in them.
Not at all. And I'm sorry, but I looked at the apartment that these people live in. I said, damn, what must they be paying for rent?
Lord knows. It's about a film student who is actually writing his thesis on Hitchcock.
On Hitchcock.
He's living in Rome, he has a girlfriend, and he likes to look across the way. Much like a certain other Hitchcock hero, played by Jimmy Stewart, he likes to look into his binoculars at the pretty girl across the way.
You can't really blame her because she likes walking around with no clothes
on. That's true. She's pretty horribly abused by her mom.
Yeah, she lives with her mother.
Yeah.
Because every time that he's looking through and he sees that her and the mother, they're always going back and forth at each other.
Then he witnesses the mother getting killed. And this leads into this plot, which is, if you know the phrase, a mashup.
It's Hitchcock's greatest hits.
Yeah, it's here's the lesbian lovers, who also happen to be Farley Granger and the other guy from Strangers on a Train.
Right, because he runs into the girl he's been spying on through the binoculars. They go to the same video store.
Mm-hmm.
The guy who runs the video store says, oh yeah, that's so-and-so, and so, you know, she asks about you. And this girl always comes and rents out Strangers on a Train.
Which, by the way, people, if you're doing a tribute to a certain film, you shouldn't keep mentioning it. What people forget about doing tributes is that if you keep mentioning the source material, people might go, well, why am I watching this when I can watch the source material?
Yeah, because they mentioned Strangers on a Train so many times that when she meets this blonde girl, and there's a scene where the film student notices that they keep getting together. There's one day he's riding his bike through the park and he sees them talking. This is one thing that Brian De Palma does in all of his movies. He loves having these long wordless sequences where nobody's saying anything and you got to kind of interpret what's going on.
But to be fair, Argento has done this before. Bird with the Crystal Plumage.
Well, that's true. It
revolves around the fact that Tony Musante is looking at a scene where he can't hear what's going on, and he takes the wrong impression.
And that's what this film student does. He's looking at the two girls talking. And it's never really made clear if they are actually lesbians. Right. I don't know. You do get that impression.
But the blonde, much like Marnie, has this weird relationship with her boss.
Yeah.
Where he's blackmailing her because of something.
She stole some money, and he's blackmailing her into having sex. The girl across the way, her mother gets killed, and the film student gets it into his head as he tells his girl, well, they did the Strangers on a Train number.
Right.
It was the blonde that killed her. He said, now I got to find out who the blonde once did. He runs around the movie being a stalker, really.
Right, oh, right. You know.
We come up against the same situation with Chris Rydell, is that this guy is never quite likable.
Right, because he's a peeping Tom. He's looking through people's windows all the time, and he doesn't have the courage of his conviction to go to the police, who, again, are ineffectual in this
right.
world.
He'd rather just run around Rome, following people and spying on them and coming up with these wild conclusions. And his girlfriend says very sensibly, "You're not a detective. What are you doing this shit for?
Right.
If you think there's something going on, go to the police. Mm-hmm. You're a film student." And she walks out on him one time. And you can't blame him. He said, "Well, why are you obsessing about this girl?" And he mm-hmm. admits that he spies on through the window. She said, "Oh, you have this." She gets the clothes and she walks out.
Which
is understandable. And he says, "Well, I don't understand why you're getting so mad."
Because you've just confessed to looking lasciviously at another woman through binoculars.
It's another... Argento character doesn't have a clue.
Mm-hmm. This all wraps up in a very Hitchcock way. This is, once again, another one of these films that was done for Rai Italy. So a lot of the Argento excesses are muted. Even though it's obvious that it's a much lower budget than some of the other films he's done.
Mm-hmm.
It does look nice.
Because I think the only time we ever really see any blood is when the mother gets
killed. The mother gets murdered, because she's spearing the blood over
right,
the window.
Right, one bloody handprint against the wall. And that's about all we see. The Hitchcock parallels, the film student, even at one point, he breaks his left leg just like Jimmy
and
Stewart did in
like,
Rear
there's
Window.
There's also like visual cues. Like, so the vertigo gets visual cued a couple of times. It's like
where the blonde is hanging from the roof and the police are trying to mm-hmm. save her and the camera is doing
right.
that kind of, that's the vertigo moment.
It's almost playing a game of Who's Skidoo watching this
somebody
movie.
Is almost murdered in the shower, going back to Psycho. Yeah, I don't know. I watched it and I guess it was because all the references were just too in my face. Okay, yeah, well, that's from Rear Window. That's from Psycho. That's from this one. That's from that one. Ho hum.
Well, see, this is why I don't like De Palma. A lot of people deride me for disliking the man's work. I look at De Palma and I can never see past his influences. He's not a filmmaker so much as a clip show maker. I remember once going on a date to see The Untouchables.
Okay.
When it was in the theater. The whole sequence of the Battleship Potemkin thing. And I'm
right.
like, oh, please. I wanted to walk up and walk away.
But at least, but let's be honest. How many people outside of film buffs like me and you have seen Battleship Potemkin? A lot of people went to see it. They didn't get that. Me and you got it. Because
people have
Channel
seen,
13 used to show Battleship Potemkin all the time.
But I'm willing to bet that a lot of people have seen Hitchcock's films.
I like De Palma when he's not trying to fences.
Yeah.
When he did The Untouchables. Mm-hmm. There was a movie he made years and years ago. Probably you're the only person besides me that's ever seen this movie. With Joe Piscopo and Danny DeVito, Wise Guys, where they played mob guys. That was like a mob comedy before they started making mob comedy.
Right.
I like that one. When he does his Hitchcock movies, it's too obvious. When your influences are too obvious, then you lose my interest.
And this is, I think, where the biggest flaw of Do You Like Hitchcock is.
Yeah.
Is that, hell, it's in the title.
Yeah.
Hey, look, I like a Hitchcock. Here's some reasons why.
Although I do have to admit, the revelation of the surprise killer, who it was, that was a surprise to me. Because I thought it was just the blonde and the brunette was involved in it together.
Yeah.
I didn't see the third person.
Yeah.
And in case you haven't seen it, folks, I'm not going to spoil it for you. I have to admit, I did not see that third person coming. Especially considering his relationship with the film student.
To me, I was like, well, why are you manipulating this poor schmuck then? Why are you doing this? Are you hoping that maybe you can find some way to frame him?
Exactly. That's the way that I played it. Okay. And then when there was no other way out, he said, well, he's as dumb as a loaf of bread anyway, so I might as well kill this dumb
man. Right. Hey, here's this bayonet thing I found lying around. And
Another thing I gotta mention too about this movie. Didn't you find the relationship that the film student had with his mother kind of creepy?
That's a Hitchcock thing.
It was kind of creepy, I thought.
But it ties in with his almost fetishistic love of Strangers on a Train that he expresses in this film. Because remember, there's that whole weird, semi-implied, incestuous thing going on with the one character.
Right, Frolic Ranger.
Frolic Ranger.
Right.
That's how I took it. It's like, okay.
Yeah, the mother, she's not acting quite like a mother.
Mm-hmm.
She's acting kind of like, I don't know. I found it bordering on the creepy-ish. But I just chalked it down to Argento being creepy.
Being creepy.
Because he is creepy.
No, we love you, Dario, but you got some issues.
Get some help.
To review, I think we were in agreement there's two good films in this set, and they're, oddly enough, the earliest films.
I would recommend, out of these five movies, that you see Phenomenon, if you're a Jennifer Connelly fan. And you can even see, because I think she was only like, 14 or 15 when she made this movie?
Yes.
Yeah. You can see back then, how dazzlingly beautiful she was, mm-hmm. even as a young girl, and her talent. She wasn't a seasoned actress there, but she carries herself and she comes off in a very professional manner. That I give anybody credit for that scene where she does fall in that pit with the maggots.
Yeah, oh, that's just gross. That's like, yeah. That's like, ew.
Yeah, that's an ew moment for sure. And then she climbs out. And then the woman pushes her back in. Yeah. Oh, man. This is one of Dario Argento's better movies. Yeah. And Tenebrae, I would recommend you
see
it.
I think Tenebrae, is, of the five, is the best of the ones we've discussed.
It's a whacked out movie, trust me. But it's interesting to watch. And if you can get past the goofy twist of logic to make it turn out that there's two killers in the movie instead of one, you're going
to
enjoy it.
No, I mean, there are elements to both Do You Like Hitchcock and The Car Player that are interesting, but I don't know if I would want to recommend them wholeheartedly. Maybe as a one-night rental.
Yeah.
Not something you'd want, like, on my shelf.
Tenebrae, yeah, I would want on my shelf. Phenomenon, I would want on my shelf. Bird with the Crystal Plumage,
oh, yeah, definitely.
Deep Red, I would want on my shelf. Mm-hmm. Furia, of course.
Of course, and Inferno. Yeah. Have you ever seen Inferno?
Yes, I've seen Inferno.
Inferno was actually better than Suspiria.
I think he was on acid when he did that.
Oh, part. Yeah. No, that one is, you know what the thing is? Like, I look at Suspiria and Inferno kind of like Kill Bill Volume 1 and 2.
Exactly.
Suspiria,
yeah.
Is Volume 1 where you have all the wacky, crazy shit. And Inferno is Volume 2 where you actually have the story.
Where you get the explanation. Yeah, you find out what it actually means. That's a very good way to put it. Those movies definitely. Yeah, but these ones.
The opera is another one that's like incredibly good.
No, but now that you mention it, because I do want to see Bird with the Crystal Plumage again, and I want to see opera, so I'm probably going to go on Netflix, and I'm going to order them, and I'm going to watch them, because I haven't seen Bird with the Crystal Plumage in, like, literally years.
I think we've talked briefly about coming back to Dario to talk about the entire Three Mothers trilogy.
We ought to get opera, Bird with the Crystal Plumage, and the Three Mothers trilogy, and do another Argento. Yeah, do another Argento.
Well, one that's a little more positive.
Well, I think these are fairly positive.
Well, there's only one really true, honest to God, buried in the ground,
stinker,
never
right.
see it again, and that's Trauma.
And that's Trauma, right. Yeah, that one I wouldn't even recommend, even if you are an Argento fan. Right. Now, let's face it, if you are an Argento fan, you're going to want to see these movies.
Exactly.
What I think that we're trying to say, that if you're not an Argento fan or if you've never seen his movies, these are not the ones to start with.
And we should also point
these
out
are not
that
the ones to start with.
These films are also available from Anchor Bay individually. Anchor Bay's been doing some wonderful work finding these films that have been out of print for a long time and bringing them back into circulation.
And these are the uncut original Italian versions, not the American versions that were heavily edited because of content. And they do have the wonderful commentaries, and they've got the interviews.
There's a really fascinating documentary on Argento's musical collaborator, the guy who formed Goblin.
Goblin, yeah.
They played some of the stuff from this band that he formed after Goblin, which he's playing with now. And I'm trying to find some of their stuff because it sounds really incredible.
And I wish that he had... Phenomenon has the weirdest musical score of any movie I've seen. There's the scenes that are supposed to be kind of moody. And it's like this wild, heavy rock.
Yeah,
headbanging music that's playing on the soundtrack. Who came up with this soundtrack for that movie?
It adds to the otherworldliness, though, of the film.
That's true, because I think that that's the best way to just take... They take place in this Argento-verse that's off the chain. I guess we should do the administrative stuff.
But we want to just briefly do the quick summary. We recommend Tenebrae and Phenomena wholeheartedly. If you are fans of European horror films or fans of horror films in general, you should probably pick these up and keep them in your collection. The Card Player is kind of more of a curiosity than anything else because of the all-natural filming that he did. It's not a great story, but maybe you might want to take a look at it. Do You Like Hitchcock is even more of a curiosity because it's Argento. Instead of just writing a fan letter to Cashew Cinema, I'm a Dario, age of 59, and I like a Hitchcock. He decided to make a movie.
But if it came down to those two, I would say, see, Do You Like Hitchcock instead of The Card Player.
And Trauma is just shit.
Trauma, don't bother. Don't waste your time. Don't waste your money. Trust us on this one, folks. If you listen to us this long, you know that you can trust us. Don't bother with Trauma.
Yeah, administrative. If you love us, if you hate us, if you wanna...
Think we're full of shit.
Think we're full of shit. If you want to tell us that Trauma is actually a coherent, loving movie about the triumph of the human will, you have a couple of ways to get
I'd love
in touch
to meet the
us.
Person that, thought that. I'd get a good laugh out of that one.
You can send us an email at betterinthedark@gmail.com. That's better the letter N, the dark at gmail.com. you can join our message board at betterinthedark.proboards105.com. You can even send us a little message on our website, which is betterinthedark.podomatic.com, at least for the next few weeks.
Right.
At which point we will be switching to bitd.libsyn.com, where you will find all their episodes of Better in the Dark, the comic book-based little tiny mini podcast, DJ Comics Cavalcade. And also, we want to remind everybody that if this podcast is not enough Tom and Derek goodness for you, we have a couple of books on the way to satiate your hunger. How the West Was Weird, which is an anthology of weird Western tales, will be available through Pulpwork Press, which you can access by going to www.pulpworkpress.com, where you could also order the two Derek Ferguson notebook books.
Movie review notebooks. Which has movie reviews that I've done. If you like movies, if you like what we're doing here, it's in the same vein. It's just that they're in print.
Finally, we also have coming very soon the second book in the much acclaimed Dylan series by Derek, which is called Dylan and the Golden Bell.
Legend of the Golden Bell, yeah, which will be definitely coming out this year. I'm actually writing three Dylan stories at the same time. I've got The Pirates of Zanera, which is going to be a sequel to Golden Bell.
Okay.
And one I just got a title for. So I'm up to my hips in Dylan stuff right now.
Go to their website to examine it, because I have a feeling there's going to be some more new stuff coming.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Also, Diamondback is available through Pulpworks, which is really cool.
Diamondback.
And one of these days, we will get together and do the Diamondback Elsa Dawn story we've always talked about.
Which we've always talked about, yeah. Well, this is why we're letting you guys know about Pulpworks Press right now, because there's going to be a lot more stuff coming from not only myself and Tom, but also from Josh Reynolds, Joel Jenkins, and hopefully some other people. Joel has one called The Nuclear Suitcase,
which is forthcoming.
Yeah, it's going to be coming out soon. And he's got the Dire Planet series, which if you like Edgar Rice Burroughs type of stuff, get Joel's Dire Planet series.
Right.
He's got three books in there so far, and that's really good Edgar Rice Burroughs type otherworldly action adventure type of stuff.
So there you go. So you got some nice summer reading. Get to.
There you go. And nice summer listening for us coming up. Should we take a minute to tell them about the interviews that
we're
going to be doing?
Well, we got...
Just in case they haven't been listening to the other episodes. And if you haven't been listening to the other episodes, I don't know why you haven't.
Well, particularly because we've been getting a lot of new traffic through some of the people who, for some reason, we've come to their attention.
Because we're good, plain and simple.
Next recording session after this one, which is going to be in June 6th. The people on the message board have talked about they wanted us to do some stuff with other people. So we're going to do some pilot episodes, one of which is going to feature our good friend B-Hyphen, Kellen Conley, who we're going to talk about the films of...
Spike Lee.
Spike Lee, the Great, Great Brooklynite, which is going to be the first of what we hope is a series of episodes about Great, Great Brooklynites involved in movies. We're also going to talk to our good friend Des Reddick, who runs the Dread Media podcast on the Earth2.net site, about the films directed by Clive Barker.
Clive Barker, yeah.
Which is going to be really cool. We're trying new things so that we can keep you entertained. And
we got a couple of other people in the mix. Yeah. So we've been throwing names back and forth.
We've Michael Bailey, who does this excellent... Actually, he does like three or four podcasts. The one that I know him for is Views from the Long Box. But he just started one called From Crisis to Crisis, which is available through the Superman homepage, where he's going to do every Superman comic from the end of Crisis on Infinite Earths to the beginning of Infinite Crisis. So it's going to be a long, long project.
The man does not lack ambition.
Yes. And he is going to be sitting in with us on an episode where we're going to talk about Superman in the media, starting with the radio show and going on up to Superman Returns.
That's something I'm looking forward to, because I have XM Satellite Radio, and there's a station on there that plays nothing but the old radio shows, and they've been playing Superman recently, so I've been listening to a lot of it.
I have a box set of, I think it's like the first 6 months of the Superman show.
Really?
I'll lend it to you so you can burn it to CD or something.
It's really interesting stuff, because, of course, it's radio, so you gotta listen to it, and it's interesting how
And people forget a lot of what is now considered canon in the Superman universe originated not in the comic, but in the radio show.
Right, Kryptonite.
The Daily Planet was first mentioned, even though it was the Daily Star
until
then. It was
the Daily Star, right.
Kryptonite was first mentioned there.
Jimmy Olsen.
Jimmy Olsen, the aspect of Batman and Superman knowing each other's identity.
Right.
All this is from the radio show.
Yeah, because Batman and Robin get started in a lot of episodes.
It was kind of funny because
that was like the first crossover.
What was happening was that every time Kurt Allen needed to go on vacation, they would write these stories where Superman was trapped in a closet with kryptonite, mm-hmm. and he'd be just like going,
just groaning, yeah.
So weak. And so that's when Batman and Robin would show up for 2 weeks, and they'd be like, our good friend Superman is missing. We must find him.
Radio, you gotta love. You gotta love.
You know how much one of my ambitions is to do radio drama. And right. I still want to do that one of these days.
Whatever happened to that project you were supposed to be doing with The Flash?
Things didn't quite work out with me and Dave Ellis.
David Ellis, where the hell are you?
Yeah, you're supposed to be doing a Star Trek episode with us.
If you're listening to us, David, get in contact with me.
Yeah, we still are waiting for you so we can do, because we, even though I don't like it, I committed to this. I'm going to do this Star Trek episode, but we need you on to help us out, Dave.
You ought to go see the new movie. That's perfect. The movie was made for people like you who don't like Star Trek. Seriously. You know what?
Derek, one of the things I don't like...
Don't go into movies. Wait till DVD.
About movie science fiction is the emphasis on space opera.
Okay.
People in spaceships shooting other people in spaceships.
Okay.
From what I can gather, what this Star Trek movie is hey, you know all that social commentary stuff that you guys found dragging? We took it all out, so it's just space opera.
Oh, yeah, well, this is Wrath of Khan. This is that type of movie. It's not as good as Wrath of Khan, which I still say, even after 30 years, it's still the best Star Trek movie.
Right.
It's land-bang space opera stuff. It's not the boldly going where no man has gone before and exploring strange new worlds and new civilization stuff. Yeah.
But we'll talk about this movie in more depth when we get to the next review episode.
Do that. So
but fun. Until the night, because I think we need to take a little break, because I think we might still be able to get one more episode in this recording session.
Okie dokie.
So until then, this has been Thomas DJ.
And this has been Derek Ferguson.
And no matter what you do, no matter where you go, no matter what weird guy with a loop saw wants to chop off your head during a rainstorm because you engaged in some weird botched experiment on your kids, go see that movie!
And remember that you can get the Decap-O-Matic right from here, better in the dark, for $69.99.
I am not only the creator of the Decap-O-Matic, but I am a happy customer.
Yeah.
This is Dario telling you, buongiorno!
Good night, folks. Bye-bye.
This girl, too, was killed with a razor, and your book's pages stuffed into her mouth.
Can I ask you something? If someone is killed with a Smith & Wesson revolver, do you go and interview the president of Smith & Wesson?
You've been listening to Better in the Dark, featuring Thomas E.J. and Derek Ferguson. Special thanks go out to Des Reddick of Dread Media, the Drunken Zombie Crew, Garrick from Media Nightmare, Eric Frome, and of course, the members of the Better in the Dark message board at betterinthedark.proboards.com. Better in the Dark vows from here on in to avoid creepy professors in wheelchairs who keep razor-wielding helper monkeys. Older episodes of the show are archived at bitd.lipson.com. Send all comments, praise, hate mail, and pipe bombs to betterinthedark@gmail.com. That's better, the letter N, thedark@gmail.com. Please vote for us on Podcast Alley. Better in the Dark is a Conspiracy Productions presentation. All material copyright, Thomas DJ and Derek Ferguson. Until next time, remember that there are better career options for a cartoonist than working at a television station.
You telling me not?
No, not even my office. I've got my own money.
How do you fortune your 15?
16.